Chapter 31. Götterdämmerung, The Last Days of the Third Reich. Hitler had planned to leave Berlin on April 20th, his 56th birthday, for Obersalzberg, and there direct the last stand of the Third Reich in the legendary mountain fastness of Barbarossa. Most of the ministerial offices had already moved south with their trucks full of state papers and of frantic officials desperate to get out of doomed Berlin. The Führer himself had sent most of the members of his household staff to Berchtesgaden 10 days before to prepare his mountain villa, the Berghof, for his coming. He was destined, however, never to see his beloved Alpine retreat again. The end was approaching faster than he had thought possible. The Americans and Russians were driving swiftly to a junction on the Elbe. The British were at the gates of Hamburg and Bremen and threatening to cut off Germany from occupied Denmark. In Italy, Bologna had fallen, and Alexander's allied forces were plunging into the valley of the Po. The Russians, having captured Vienna on April 13th, were heading up the Danube, and the U.S. Third Army was sweeping down that river to meet them in Hitler's hometown of Linz in Austria. Nuremberg, where work had been going on throughout the war on the great auditorium and stadiums which were to mark the ancient town as the capital of the Nazi Party, was besieged, and part of the U.S. 7th Army was sweeping past it toward Munich, the birthplace of the Nazi movement. In Berlin, the thunder of Russian heavy artillery could be heard. All through the week, Count Schwerin von Krosigk, the puerile minister of finance and former Rhodes scholar who had scooted out of Berlin for the north at the first word of the approaching Bolsheviki, noted in his diary on April 23rd, there was nothing but a succession of Job's messengers. Our people seemed to be faced with the darkest fate. Hitler had left his headquarters in Rostenburg in East Prussia for the last time on the previous November 20th, as the Russians approached, and had remained in Berlin, which he had scarcely seen since the beginning of the war in the East, until December 10th, when he had gone to his western headquarters at Ziegenberg near Bad Nauheim to direct the great gamble in the Ardennes. After its failure, he had returned on January 16th to Berlin, where he was to remain until the end, directing his crumbling armies from the underground bunker 50 feet below the Chancellery, whose great marble halls were now in ruins from Allied bombing. Physically, he was fast deteriorating. A young army captain who saw him for the first time in February later recalled his appearance. His head was slightly wobbling. His left arm hung slackly, and his hand trembled a good deal. There was an indescribable flickering glow in his eyes, creating a fearsome and wholly unnatural effect. His face and the parts around his eyes gave the impression of total exhaustion. All his movements were those of a senile man. Since the July 20th attempt on his life, he had grown distrustful of everyone, even of his old party stalwarts. "I am lied to on all sides," he fumed to one of his women secretaries in March. "I can rely on no one. They all betray me. The whole business makes me sick. If anything happens to me, Germany will be left without a leader. I have no successor. Hess is mad, Goering has lost the sympathy of the people, and Himmler would be rejected by the party. Besides, he, Himmler, is so completely inartistic. Rack your brains and tell me who my successor is to be." One would have thought that at this stage of history the question of succession was academic, but it was not. Not in this Nazi cuckoo land. Not only the Führer was obsessed by it, but the leading candidates to succeed him, as we shall shortly see. Physical wreck though Hitler now was, with a disastrous end staring him in the face as the Russians approached Berlin and the Western Allies overran the Reich, he and a few of his most fanatical followers, Goebbels above all, clung stubbornly to their hopes of being saved at the last minute by a miracle. One fine evening early in April, Goebbels had sat up reading to Hitler from one of the Führer's favorite books, Carlyle's History of Frederick the Great. The chapter he was reading told of the darkest days of the 7 Years' War, when the great king felt himself at the end of his rope, and told his ministers that if by February 15th no change for the better in his fortunes occurred, he would give up and take poison. This portion of history certainly had its appropriateness, and no doubt Goebbels read it in his most dramatic fashion. "Brave king," Goebbels read on, "wait yet a little while, and the days of your suffering will be over. Already the sun of your good fortune stands behind the clouds and soon will rise upon you." On February 12th, the Tsarina died, the miracle of the House of Brandenburg had come to pass. The Führer's eyes, Goebbels told Krosigk, to whose diary we owe this touching scene, were filled with tears. With such encouragement, and from a British source, they sent for two horoscopes which were kept in the files of one of Himmler's multitudinous research offices. One was the horoscope of the Führer drawn up on January 30, 1933, the day he took office. The other was the horoscope of the Weimar Republic, composed by some unknown astrologer on November 9, 1918, the day of the Republic's birth. Goebbels communicated the results of the re-examination of these two remarkable documents to Krosigk. An amazing fact has become evident, both horoscopes predicting the outbreak of the war in 1939, the victories until 1941, and the subsequent series of reversals, with the hardest blows during the first months of 1945, particularly during the first half of April. In the second half of April, we were to experience a temporary success. Then there would be stagnation until August and peace that same month. For the following 3 years, Germany would have a hard time, but starting in 1948, she would rise again. Fortified by Carlyle and the amazing predictions of the stars, Goebbels on April 6th issued a ringing appeal to the retreating troops. The Führer has declared that even in this very year a change of fortune shall come. The true quality of genius is its consciousness and its sure knowledge of coming change. The Führer knows the exact hour of its arrival. Destiny has sent us this man so that we, in this time of great external and internal stress, shall testify to the miracle. Scarcely a week later, on the night of April 12th, Goebbels convinced himself that the exact hour of the miracle had come. It had been a day of further bad news. The Americans had appeared on the Dessau-Berlin Autobahn, and the High Command had hastily ordered the destruction of its last two remaining powder factories, which were in the vicinity. Henceforth, the German soldiers would have to get along with the ammunition at hand. Goebbels had spent the day at the headquarters of General Busse on the Oder front at Küstrin. The general had assured him that a Russian breakthrough was impossible, that, as Goebbels the next day told Krosigk, he was holding out until the British kick us in the ass. In the evening, Goebbels recounted, they had sat together at headquarters, and he had developed his thesis that, according to historical logic and justice, things were bound to change, just as in the 7 Years' War there had been the miracle of the House of Brandenburg. "What Tsarina will die this time?" an officer asked. Goebbels did not know, but fate, he replied, holds all sorts of possibilities. When the propaganda minister got back to Berlin late that night, the center of the capital was in flames from another RAF bombing. The remains of the Chancellery and the Adlon Hotel up the Wilhelmstrasse were burning. At the steps of the propaganda ministry, a secretary greeted Goebbels with a piece of urgent news. "Roosevelt," he said, "is dead." The minister's face lit up, visible to all in the light of the flames from the Chancellery across the Wilhelmplatz. "Bring out our best champagne," Goebbels cried, "and get me the Führer on the telephone." Hitler was in his deep bunker across the way, sitting out the bombing. He picked up the telephone. "My Führer," Goebbels said, "I congratulate you. Roosevelt is dead. It is written in the stars that the second half of April will be the turning point for us. This is Friday, April the 13th. It was already after midnight. It is the turning point." Hitler's reaction to the news was not recorded, though it may be imagined in view of the encouragement he had been receiving from Carlyle and the stars. But that of Goebbels was. "He was," says his secretary, "in ecstasy." The fatuous Count Schwerin von Krosigk, too. When Goebbels's state secretary phoned him that Roosevelt was dead, he exclaimed, at least in his faithful diary, "This was the angel of history. We felt its wings flutter through the room. Was that not the turn of fortune we awaited so anxiously?" The next morning, Krosigk telephoned Goebbels with his congratulations, he affirms it proudly in his diary, and, as if this were not enough, followed it with a letter in which he hailed Roosevelt's death, he says, as a divine judgment, a gift from God. In this atmosphere of a lunatic asylum, with cabinet ministers long in power and educated in Europe's ancient universities, as Krosigk and Goebbels were, grasping at the readings of the stars, and rejoicing amidst the flames of the burning capital in the death of the American president as a sure sign that the Almighty would now rescue the Third Reich at the 11th hour from impending catastrophe, the last act in Berlin was played out to its final curtain. Eva Braun had arrived in Berlin to join Hitler on April 15th. Very few Germans knew of her existence, and even fewer of her relationship to Adolf Hitler. For more than 12 years, she had been his mistress. Now in April, she had come, as Trevor Roper says, for her wedding and her ceremonial death. She is interesting for her role in the last chapter of this narrative, but not interesting in herself. She was not a Pompadour or a Lola Montez. For all writers of history, Speer told Trevor Roper, Eva Braun is going to be a disappointment, to which the historian adds, and for readers of history too, Trevor Roper, The Last Days of Hitler, page 92. Hitler, although he was undoubtedly extremely fond of her and found relaxation in her unobtrusive company, had always kept her out of sight, refusing to allow her to come to his various headquarters, where he spent almost all of his time during the war years, and rarely permitting her even to come to Berlin. She remained immured at the Berghof on the Obersalzberg, passing her time in swimming and skiing, in reading cheap novels and seeing trashy films, in dancing, which Hitler disapproved of, and endlessly grooming herself, pining away for her absent loved one. She was, says Erich Kempke, the Führer's chauffeur, the unhappiest woman in Germany. She spent most of her life waiting for Hitler. Field Marshal Keitel described her appearance during an interrogation at Nuremberg. She was very slender, elegant appearance, quite nice legs, one could see that, reticent and retiring, and a very, very nice person, dark blonde. She stood very much in the background, and one saw her very rarely. The daughter of lower-middle-class Bavarian parents, who at first strenuously opposed her illicit relation with Hitler, even though he was the dictator, she had been employed in the Munich photograph shop of Heinrich Hofmann, who introduced her to the Führer. This was a year or two after the suicide of Gaily Raubal, the niece of Hitler, for whom, as we have seen, he had the one great passionate love of his life. Eva Braun, too, it seems, was often driven to despair by her lover, though not for the same reasons as Gaily Raubal. Eva, though installed in a suite in Hitler's Alpine villa, couldn't endure the long separations when he was away, and twice tried to kill herself in the early years of their friendship. But gradually she accepted her frustrating and ambiguous role, acknowledged neither as wife nor as mistress, content to be sole woman companion of the great man and making the most of their rare moments together. She was now determined to share his end. Like Dr. and Frau Goebbels, she had no desire to live in a Germany without Adolf Hitler. It would not be fit to live in for a true German, she told Hannah Reitsch, the famed German woman test pilot, in the shelter just before the end. Though Eva Braun had a bird-like mind and made no intellectual impression on Hitler at all, perhaps this is one reason he preferred her company to that of intelligent women, it is obvious that his influence on her, as on so many others, was total. Hitler's last great decision. Hitler's birthday on April 20th passed quietly enough, although, as General Karl Kohler, the Air Force Chief of Staff, who was present at the celebration in the bunker, noted in his diary, it was a day of further catastrophes on the rapidly disintegrating fronts. All the old guard Nazis, Göring, Goebbels, Himmler, Ribbentrop, and Bormann, were there, as well as the surviving military leaders, Dönitz, Keitel, Jodl, and Krebs, the last named the new and last chief of the Army General Staff. They offered the Führer birthday congratulations. The warlord was not unusually cast down, despite the situation. He was still confident, as he had told his generals 3 days before, that the Russians were going to suffer their bloodiest defeat of all before Berlin. The generals knew better, and at the regular military conference after the birthday party, they urged Hitler to leave Berlin for the south. In a day or two, they explained, the Russians would cut off the last escape corridor in that direction. Hitler hesitated. He would not say yes or no. Apparently, he could not quite face the appalling fact that the capital of the Third Reich was now about to be captured by the Russians, whose armies, he had announced years before, were as good as destroyed. As a concession to the generals, he consented to setting up two separate commands in case the Americans and Russians made their junction on the Elbe. Admiral Dönitz would head that in the north, and perhaps Kesselring the one in the south. He was not quite sure about the latter appointment. That night there was a general getaway from Berlin. Two of the Führer's most trusted and veteran aides got out, Himmler and Goering, the latter in a motor caravan whose trucks were filled with booty from his fabulous estate, Karinhall. Each of these old guard Nazis left convinced that his beloved leader would soon be dead and that he would succeed him. They never saw him again, nor did Ribbentrop, who also scurried for safer parts late that night. But Hitler had not yet given up. On the day after his birthday, he ordered an all-out counterattack on the Russians in the southern suburbs of Berlin by SS General Felix Steiner. Every available soldier in the Berlin area was to be thrown into the attack, including the Luftwaffe ground troops. "Any commander who holds back his forces," Hitler shouted to General Kohler, who had remained behind to represent the Air Force, "will forfeit his life in 5 hours. You yourself will guarantee with your head that the last man is thrown in." All through the day and far into the next, Hitler waited impatiently for the news of Steiner's counterattack. It was a further example of his loss of contact with reality. There was no Steiner attack. It was never attempted. It existed only in the feverish mind of the desperate dictator. When he was finally forced to recognize this, the storm broke. April 22nd brought the last turning point in Hitler's road to ruin. From early morning until 3 p.m. he had been on the telephone, as he had been the day before, trying to find out from the various command posts how the Steiner counterattack was going. No one knew. General Kohler's planes could not locate it, nor could the ground commanders, though it was supposed to be rolling only 2 or 3 miles south of the capital. Not even Steiner, though he existed, could be found, let alone his army. The blow-up came at the daily military conference in the bunker at 3 p.m. Hitler angrily demanded news of Steiner. Neither Keitel, nor Jodl, nor anyone else had any. But the generals had other news. The withdrawal of troops from the north of Berlin to support Steiner had so weakened the front there that the Russians had broken through, and their tanks were now within the city limits. This was too much for the supreme warlord. All of the surviving witnesses testified that he completely lost control of himself. He flew into the greatest rage of his life. "This was the end," he shrieked. "Everyone had deserted him. There was nothing but treason, lies, corruption, and cowardice. All was over." Very well, he would stay on in Berlin. He would personally take over the defense of the capital of the Third Reich. The others could leave if they wished. In this place he would meet his end. The others protested. There was still hope, they said, if the Führer retired to the south, where Field Marshal Ferdinand Schirner's army group in Czechoslovakia and considerable forces of Kesselring were still intact. Dönitz, who had left for the northwest to take over command of the troops there, and Himmler, who, as we shall see, was up to his own game, telephoned to urge the leader not to remain in Berlin. Even Ribbentrop called up to say he was about to spring a diplomatic coup which would save everything. But Hitler had no more faith in them, not even in his second Bismarck, as he once, in a moment of folly, had called his foreign minister. He had made his decision, he said to all, and to show them that it was irrevocable, he called for a secretary, and in their presence dictated an announcement that was to be read immediately over the radio. The Führer, it said, would stay in Berlin and defend it to the end. Hitler then sent for Goebbels and invited him, his wife, and their 6 young children to move into the Führer bunker, from their badly bombed house in the Wilhelmstrasse garden. He knew that at least this fanatical and faithful follower and his family would stick by him to the end. Next, Hitler turned to his papers, sorted out those he wished to be destroyed, and turned them over to one of his adjutants, Julius Schaub, who took them up to the garden and burned them. Finally, that evening, he called in Keitel and Jodl and ordered them to proceed south to take over direct command of the remaining armed forces. Both generals, who had been at Hitler's side throughout the war, have left vivid accounts of their final parting with the supreme warlord. When Keitel protested that he would not leave without the Führer, Hitler answered, "You will follow my orders." Keitel, who had never disobeyed an order from the leader in his life, not even those commanding him to commit the vilest war crimes, said nothing further. But Jodl, less a lackey, did. To this soldier, who, despite his fanatical devotion to the Führer whom he had served so well, still retained some sense of military tradition, the supreme warlord was deserting the command of his troops and shirking his responsibility for them at a moment of disaster. "You can't direct anything from here," Jodl said. "If you don't have your leadership staff with you, how can you lead anything?" "Well then," Hitler retorted, "Goering can take over the leadership down there." When one of them pointed out that no soldier would fight for the Reich Marshal, Hitler cut in, "What do you mean, fight? There's precious little more fighting to be done." Even for the mad conqueror, the scales at last were falling from the eyes. Or at least, the gods were giving him moments of lucidity in these last nightmarish days of his life. There were several repercussions to Hitler's outbursts on April 22nd and to his final decision to remain in Berlin. When Himmler, who was at Hohenlicken, northwest of Berlin, received a first-hand account on the telephone from Hermann Fegelein, his SS liaison officer at headquarters, he exclaimed to his entourage, "Everyone is mad in Berlin. What am I to do?" "You go straight to Berlin," replied one of Himmler's principal aides, Obergruppenführer Gottlob Berger, the chief of the SS head office. Berger was one of those simple Germans who sincerely believed in National Socialism. He had no idea that his revered chief, Himmler, under the prodding of SS General Walter Schellenberg, was already in touch with Count Folke Bernadotte of Sweden about surrendering the German armies in the West. "I am going to Berlin," Berger said to Himmler, "and it is your duty to go too." Berger, but not Himmler, went to Berlin that night, and his visit is of interest because of his first-hand description of Hitler on the night of his great decision. Russian shells were already bursting near the Chancellery when Berger arrived. To his shock, he found the Führer a broken man, finished. When he ventured to express his appreciation of Hitler's resolve to remain in Berlin, "One couldn't desert the people after they had held out so loyally and long," he says he declared. The very words touched off the leader again. All this time, Berger later recounted, the Führer had never uttered a word. Then suddenly he shrieked, "Everyone has deceived me. No one has told me the truth. The armed forces have lied to me." He went on and on in a loud voice. Then his face went bluish purple. I thought he was going to have a stroke any minute. Berger was also the head of Himmler's prisoner of war administration, and after the Führer had calmed down, they discussed the fate of a group of prominent British, French, and American prisoners, as well as of such Germans as Halder and Schacht and the former Austrian Chancellor, Schuschnigg, who were being moved southeast to keep them out of the hands of the Americans advancing through Germany. Berger was flying to Bavaria that night to take charge of them. The two men also talked of reports that there had been outbreaks of separatism in Austria and Bavaria. The idea that revolt could break out in his native Austria and in his adopted Bavaria once more convulsed Hitler. His hand was shaking, his leg was shaking, and his head was shaking, and all that he kept saying, Berger reported, was, "Shoot them all! Shoot them all!" Whether this was an order to shoot all the separatists or all the distinguished prisoners or both was not clear to Berger. But apparently to this simple man it meant the whole lot. Goering and Himmler tried to take over. General Kohler had stayed away from the Führer's military conference on April 22nd. He had the Luftwaffe to look after, and besides, he says in his diary, "I should never have been able to tolerate being insulted all day long." General Eckhard Christian, his liaison officer at the bunker, had rung him up at 6:15 p.m., and in a breathless voice had said, "Historical events, the most decisive of the war, are taking place here." A couple of hours later, Christian arrived at Air Force headquarters at Wildparkwerder on the outskirts of Berlin to report to Kohler in person. "The Führer has broken down." Christian, an ardent Nazi who had married one of Hitler's secretaries, gasped, but beyond saying that the leader had decided to meet his end in Berlin and was burning his papers, he was so incoherent that the Luftwaffe chief of staff set out, despite a heavy British bombing that had just begun, to find General Jodl and ascertain just what had happened that day in the bunker. At Kramnitz, between Berlin and Potsdam, where the now Führerless OKW had set up temporary headquarters, he found him, and Jodl told his Air Force friend the whole sad story. He also revealed something which no one else had yet mentioned to Kohler and which was to lead to a certain denouement during the next few frantic days. "When it comes to negotiating for peace," Hitler had told Keitel and Jodl, "Goering can do better than I. Goering is much better at those things. He can deal much better with the other side." Jodl now repeated this to Kohler. The Air Force general felt that it was his duty to immediately fly to Goering. It would be difficult and also dangerous, in view of the enemy's monitoring, to try to explain this new development in a radio message. If Goering, who had been officially named by Hitler years before as his successor designate, were to take over peace negotiations as the Führer had suggested, there was no time to lose. Jodl agreed. At 3:30 on the morning of April 23rd, Kohler took off in a fighter plane and sped toward Munich. At noon he arrived on the Obersalzberg and delivered his news to the Reich Marshal. Goering, who had been looking forward, to put it mildly, to the day when he might succeed Hitler, was more circumspect than might have been expected. He did not want to lay himself open, he said, to the machinations of his deadly enemy, Bormann, a precaution which, as it turned out, was well-founded. He perspired under his dilemma. "If I act now," he told his advisers, "I may be stamped as a traitor. If I don't act, I'll be accused of having failed to do something in the hour of disaster." Goering sent for Hans Lammers, the state secretary of the Reich Chancellery, who was in Berchtesgaden, for legal advice, and also fetched from his safe a copy of the Führer's decree of June 29, 1941. The decree was quite clear. It stipulated that if Hitler died, Goering was to be his successor, and that if the Führer were incapacitated, Goering was to act as his deputy. All agreed that by remaining in Berlin to die, cut off in his last hours from both the military commands and the government offices, Hitler was incapacitated from governing, and that it was Goering's clear duty under the decree to take over. Nevertheless, the Reich Marshal drafted his telegram to Hitler with great care. He wanted to make sure of the delegation of authority. "My Führer, in view of your decision to remain in the fortress of Berlin, do you agree that I take over at once the total leadership of the Reich, with full freedom of action at home and abroad as your deputy in accordance with your decree of June 29, 1941? If no reply is received by 10 o'clock tonight, I shall take it for granted that you have lost your freedom of action and shall consider the conditions of your decree as fulfilled and shall act for the best interests of our country and our people. You know what I feel for you in this gravest hour of my life. Words fail me to express myself. May God protect you and speed you quickly here in spite of all. Your loyal, Hermann Goering." That very evening, several hundred miles away, Heinrich Himmler was meeting with Count Bernadotte in the Swedish consulate at Lübeck on the Baltic. Der treue Heinrich, the loyal Heinrich, as Hitler had often fondly referred to him, was not asking for the powers of succession. He was already assuming them. "The Führer's great life," he told the Swedish Count, "is drawing to a close. In a day or two," he said, "Hitler would be dead." Whereupon Himmler urged Bernadotte to communicate to General Eisenhower immediately Germany's willingness to surrender to the West. In the East, Himmler added, the war would be continued until the Western powers themselves had taken over the front against the Russians. Such was the naivete, or stupidity, or both, of this SS chieftain, who now claimed for himself the dictatorship of the Third Reich. When Bernadotte asked that Himmler put in writing his offer to surrender, a letter was hastily drafted by candlelight. For an RAF bombing that night had shut off the electricity in Lübeck, and driven the confreres to the cellar. Himmler signed it. Both Goering and Himmler had acted prematurely, as they quickly found out. Although Hitler was cut off from all but a scanty radio communication with his armies and his ministries, for the Russians had nearly completed their encirclement of the capital by the evening of the 23rd, he was now to demonstrate that he could rule Germany by the power of his personality and prestige alone, and quell treason, even by the most eminent of his followers, by a mere word over his creaky wireless transmitter suspended from a balloon above the bunker. Albert Speer and a remarkable lady witness whose dramatic appearance in the last act of the drama in Berlin will shortly be noted, have described Hitler's reaction to Goering's telegram. Speer had flown into the besieged capital on the night of April 23rd, landing in a Cub plane on the eastern end of the east-west axis, the broad avenue which led through the Tiergarten, at the Brandenburg Gate, a block from the Chancellery. Having learned that Hitler had decided to remain in Berlin to the end, which could not be far off, Speer had come to say his farewell to the leader and to confess to him that his conflict between personal loyalty and public duty, as he puts it, had forced him to sabotage the Führer's scorched-earth policy. He fully expected to be arrested for treason and probably shot, and no doubt he would have been had the dictator known of Speer's effort 2 months before to kill him and all the others who had escaped Stauffenberg's bomb. The brilliant architect and armament minister, though he had always prided himself on being apolitical, had had, like some other Germans, a too late awakening. When he had finally realized that his beloved Führer was determined, through his scorched-earth decrees, to destroy the German people, he had decided to murder him. His plan was to introduce poison gas into the ventilation system in the bunker in Berlin during a full-dress military conference. Since not only the generals but invariably Goering, Himmler, and Goebbels now attended these, Speer hoped to wipe out the entire Nazi leadership of the Third Reich as well as the high command. He procured his gas, inspected the air conditioning system, and then discovered, he says, that the air intake pipe in the garden was protected by a 12-foot-high chimney, recently installed on Hitler's personal orders to discourage sabotage, and that it would be impossible to inject his gas into it without being interrupted by the SS guards in the garden. So he abandoned his project, and Hitler once again escaped assassination. Now, on the evening of April 23rd, Speer made a full confession of his insubordination in refusing to carry out the wanton destruction of Germany's remaining installations. To his surprise, Hitler showed no resentment or anger. Perhaps the Führer was touched by the candor and courage of his young friend, Speer had just turned 40, for whom he had long had a deep affection and whom he regarded as a fellow artist. Hitler, as Keitel also noted, seemed strangely serene that evening, as though having made up his mind to die in this place within a few days had brought a peace of mind and spirit. But it was the calm not only after the storm of the previous day, but before the storm. For Goering's telegram had meanwhile arrived in the Chancellery, and after being held up by Bormann, who saw his opportunity at last, was presented to the Führer by this master of intrigue as an ultimatum, and as a treasonous attempt to usurp the leader's power. Hitler was highly enraged, says Speer, and expressed himself very strongly about Goering. He said he had known for some time that Goering had failed, that he was corrupt and a drug addict, a statement which extremely shook the young architect, since he wondered why Hitler had employed such a man in so high a post so long. Speer was also puzzled when Hitler calmed down and added, "Well, let Goering negotiate the capitulation all the same. It doesn't matter anyway who does it." But this mood lasted only a few moments. Before the discussion was finished, Hitler, prompted by Bormann, dictated a telegram informing Goering that he had committed high treason, for which the penalty was death, but that because of his long service to the Nazi party and state, his life would be spared if he immediately resigned all his offices. He was ordered to answer with one word, yes or no. This did not satisfy the worm-like Bormann. On his own hook, he got off a radiogram to the SS headquarters in Berchtesgaden, ordering the immediate arrest of Goering, his staff, and Lammers for high treason. Before dawn the next day, the number two man of the Third Reich, the most arrogant and opulent of the Nazi princes, the only Reich Marshal in German history and the commander-in-chief of the Air Force, found himself a prisoner of the SS. 3 days later, on the evening of April 26th, Hitler expressed himself even more strongly on the subject of Goering than he had in the presence of Speer. The last two visitors to the bunker. Two more interesting visitors had meanwhile arrived in the madhouse of the Führer's bunker. Hanna Reitsch, the crack woman test pilot who, among other qualities, had a capacity for monumental hatred, especially of Goering, and General Ritter von Greim, who on April 24th had been summoned from Munich to appear personally before the Supreme Warlord, and had done so, though the plane in which he and Reitsch flew the last lap on the evening of the 26th had been torn over the Tiergarten by Russian anti-aircraft shells, and Grimes' foot had been shattered. Hitler came into the surgery where a physician was dressing the general's wound. Hitler: "Do you know why I have called you?" Grime: "No, my Führer." Hitler: "Because Hermann Goering has betrayed and deserted both me and his fatherland. Behind my back he has established contact with the enemy. His action was a mark of cowardice. Against my orders, he has gone to save himself at Berchtesgaden. From there, he sent me a disrespectful telegram. It was..." At this point, says Hanna Reitsch, who was present, the Führer's face began to twitch, and his breath came in explosive puffs. Hitler: "An ultimatum! A crass ultimatum! Now nothing remains. Nothing is spared me. No allegiances are kept. No honor lived up to. No disappointments that I have not had, no betrayals that I have not experienced, and now this above all else. Nothing remains. Every wrong has already been done me. I immediately had Goering arrested as a traitor to the Reich, took from him all his offices, and removed him from all organizations. That is why I have called you." Then and there he named the startled general lying wounded on his cot, the new commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe. A promotion he could have made by radio, which would have spared Grime a crippled foot and left him at headquarters, the only place from which what was left of the Air Force could be directed. 3 days later, Hitler ordered Grime, who by now, like Fräulein Reich, expected and indeed desired to die in the bunker at the side of the leader, to depart in order to deal with a new case of treachery. For treason, as we have seen, was not confined among the leaders of the Third Reich to Hermann Goering. During those 3 days, Hanna Reich had ample opportunity to observe the lunatic life in the underground madhouse. Indeed, she participated in it. Since she was as emotionally unstable as her distinguished host, the account she has left of it is lurid and melodramatic. And yet it is probably largely true and even fairly accurate, for it has been checked against other eyewitness reports, and is thus of importance for the closing chapter of this history. Late on the night of her arrival with General von Grime, it was April 26th, Russian shells began falling on the Chancellery, and the thud of the explosions and the sound of crashing walls above increased the tension in the bunker. Hitler took the aviatrix aside. "My Führer, why do you stay?" she said. "Why do you deprive Germany of your life? The Führer must live so that Germany can live. The people demand it." "No, Hanna," she says, the Führer replied. "If I die, it is for the honor of our country. It is because as a soldier I must obey my own command that I would defend Berlin to the last." "My dear girl," he continued, "I did not intend it so. I believed firmly that Berlin would be saved on the banks of the Oder. When our best efforts failed, I was the most horror-struck of all. Then, when the encirclement of the city began, I believed that by staying all the troops of the land would take example from my act and come to the rescue of the city. But, my Hanna, I still have hope. The army of General Wenck is moving up from the south. He must and will drive the Russians back long enough to save our people. Then we will fall back to hold again." That was one mood of Hitler that evening. He still had hope in General Wenck's relieving Berlin. But a few moments later, as the Russian bombardment of the Chancellery reached great intensity, he was in despair again. He handed Reich a vial of poison for herself and one for Grime. "Hanna," he said, "you belong to those who will die with me. I do not wish that one of us falls to the Russians alive, nor do I wish our bodies to be found by them. Eva and I will have our bodies burned. You will devise your own method." Hanna took the vial of poison to Grime, and they decided that, should the end really come, they would swallow the poison, and then, to make sure, pull a pin from a heavy grenade and hold it tightly to their bodies. A day and a half later, on the 28th, Hitler's hopes seemed to have risen again, or at least his delusions. He radioed Keitel, "I expect the relief of Berlin. What is Heinrich's army doing? Where is Wenck? What is happening to the Ninth Army? When will Wenck and Ninth Army join?" Reich describes the Supreme Warlord that day, striding about the shelter, waving a road map that was fast disintegrating from the sweat of his hands, and planning Wenck's campaign with anyone who happened to be listening. But Wenck's campaign, like the Steiner attack of a week before, existed only in the Führer's imagination. Wenck's army had already been liquidated, as had the Ninth Army. Heinrich's army, to the north of Berlin, was beating a hasty retreat westward so that it might be captured by the Western Allies instead of by the Russians. All through April 28th, the desperate men in the bunker waited for news of the counterattacks of these three armies, especially that of Wenck. Russian spearheads were now but a few blocks from the Chancellery, and advancing slowly toward it up several streets from the east and north, and through the nearby Tiergarten from the west. When no news of the relieving forces came, Hitler, prompted by Bormann, began to expect new treacheries. At 8 p.m., Bormann got out a radiogram to Dönitz. "Instead of urging the troops forward to our rescue, the men in authority are silent. Treachery seems to have replaced loyalty. We remain here. The Chancellery is already in ruins." Later that night, Bormann sent another message to Dönitz. "Schöner, Wenck, and others must prove their loyalty to the Führer by coming to the Führer's aid as soon as possible." Bormann was now speaking for himself. Hitler had made up his mind to die in a day or two, but Bormann wanted to live. He might not succeed the Führer, but he wanted to continue to pull the strings behind the scenes for whoever did. Finally, that night, Admiral Voss got out a message to Dönitz saying that all radio connection with the army had broken down, and urgently requesting the Navy to send over the naval wavelength some news of what was happening in the outside world. Very shortly, some news came, not from the Navy, but from the listening post in the propaganda ministry, and it was shattering for Adolf Hitler. Besides Bormann, there was another Nazi official in the bunker who wanted to live. This was Hermann Fegelein, Himmler's representative at court and typical of the type of German who rose to prominence under Hitler's rule. A former groom and then a jockey and quite illiterate, he was a protégé of the notorious Christian Weber, one of Hitler's oldest party cronies and himself a horse fancier, who by fraudulence had amassed a fortune and a great racing stable after 1933. Fegelein, with Weber's help, had climbed quite high in the Third Reich. He was a general in the Waffen-SS, and in 1944, shortly after being appointed Himmler's liaison officer at Führer headquarters, he had further advanced his position at court by marrying Eva Braun's sister, Gretel. All the surviving SS chiefs agree that, in alliance with Bormann, Fegelein lost no time in betraying his own SS chief, Himmler, to Hitler. But, disreputable, illiterate, and ignorant though he was, Fegelein seems to have been possessed of a Simon Pure instinct for survival. He knew a sinking ship when he saw one. On April 26th, he quietly left the bunker. By the next afternoon, Hitler had noticed his disappearance. The Führer's easily aroused suspicions were kindled, and he sent out an armed SS search party to try to find the man. He was found, in civilian clothes, resting in his home in the Charlottenburg district, which the Russians were about to overrun. Brought back to the Chancellery, he was stripped of his SS rank of Obergruppenführer and placed under arrest. Fegelein's attempted desertion made Hitler immediately suspicious of Himmler. What was the SS chief up to, now that he had deliberately absented himself from Berlin? There had been no news since his liaison officer, Fegelein, had quit his post. It now came. April 28th, as we have seen, had been a trying day in the bunker. The Russians were getting close. The expected news of Wenck's counterattack, or of any counterattack, had not come through. Desperately, the besieged had asked through the Navy's radio for news of developments outside the encircled city. The radio listening post of the propaganda ministry had picked up from a broadcast of the BBC in London one piece of news of what was happening outside Berlin. It was a Reuters dispatch from Stockholm, and it was so sensational, so incredible, that one of Goebbels's assistants, Heinz Lorenz, had scampered across the shell-torn square late on the evening of April 28th to the bunker with copies of it for his minister and for the Führer. The dispatch, says Reich, struck a death blow to the entire assembly. Men and women alike screamed with rage, fear, and desperation, all mixed into one emotional spasm. Hitler's spasm was the worst. He raged, says the aviatrix, like a madman. Heinrich Himmler, Der Treue Heinrich, had also deserted the sinking ship of state. The Reuters dispatch told of his secret negotiations with Count Bernadotte and his offer to surrender the German armies in the west to Eisenhower. To Hitler, who had never doubted Himmler's absolute loyalty, this was the heaviest blow of all. His color, says Reich, rose to a heated red and his face was virtually unrecognizable. After the lengthy outburst, Hitler sank into a stupor, and for a time the entire bunker was silent. Goering, at least, had asked the leader's permission to take over, but the Treue SS chief and Reichsfuhrer had not bothered to ask. He had treasonably contacted the enemy without saying a word. This, Hitler told his followers, when he had somewhat recovered, was the worst act of treachery he had ever known. This blow, coupled with the news received a few minutes later that the Russians were nearing the Potsdamer Platz, but a block away, and would probably storm the Chancellery on the morning of April 30th, 30 hours hence, was the signal for the end. It forced Hitler to make immediately the last decisions of his life. By dawn, he had married Eva Braun, drawn up his last will and testament, dispatched Grime and Hanna Reich to rally the Luftwaffe for an all-out bombing of the Russian forces approaching the Chancellery, and ordered them also to arrest Himmler as a traitor. "A traitor must never succeed me as Führer," Hanna says he told them. You must get out to ensure that he will not. Hitler could not wait to begin his revenge against Himmler. He had the SS chief's liaison man, Fegelein, in his hands. The former jockey and present SS general was now brought out of the guardhouse, closely questioned as to Himmler's betrayal, accused of having been an accomplice in it, and on the Führer's orders taken up to the Chancellery Garden and shot. The fact that Fegelein was married to Eva Braun's sister did not help him. Eva made no effort to save her brother-in-law's life. Poor, poor Adolf, she whimpered to Hanna Reich. Deserted by everyone, betrayed by all. Better that 10,000 others die than that he be lost to Germany. He was lost to Germany, but in those final hours he was won by Eva Braun. Sometime between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. on April 29th, as a crowning award for her loyalty to the end, he accorded his mistress's wish and formally married her. He had always said that marriage would interfere with his complete dedication to leading first his party to power and then his nation to the heights. Now that there was no more leading to do and his life was at an end, he could safely enter into a marriage which could last only a few hours. Goebbels rounded up a municipal councillor, one Walter Wagner, who was fighting in a unit of the Volkssturm not many blocks away, and this surprised official performed the ceremony in the small conference room of the bunker. The marriage document survives and gives part of the picture of what one of the Führer's secretaries described as the death marriage. Hitler asked that, in view of war developments, the publication of the banns be done orally and all other delays be avoided. The bride and groom-to-be swore they were of complete Aryan descent and had no hereditary disease to exclude their marriage. On the eve of death, the dictator insisted on sticking to form. Only in the spaces given to the name of his father, born Schickelgruber, and his mother, and the date of their marriage, did Hitler leave a blank. His bride started to sign her name, Eva Braun, but stopped, crossed out the B, and wrote, Eva Hitler, born Braun. Goebbels and Bormann signed as witnesses. After the brief ceremony, there was a macabre wedding breakfast in the Führer's private apartment. Champagne was brought out, and even Fräulein Manziali, Hitler's vegetarian cook, was invited, along with his secretaries, the remaining generals, Krebs and Bergdorf, Bormann and Dr. and Frau Goebbels, to share in the wedding celebration. For a time, the talk gravitated to the good old times and the party comrades of better days. Hitler spoke fondly of the occasion on which he had been best man at the Goebbels' wedding. As was his custom, even to the very last, the bridegroom talked on and on, reviewing the high points in his dramatic life. Now it was ended, he said, and so was National Socialism. It would be a release for him to die, since he had been betrayed by his oldest friends and supporters. The wedding party was plunged into gloom, and some of the guests stole away in tears. Hitler finally slipped away himself. In an adjoining room he summoned one of his secretaries, Frau Gertrude Junge, and began to dictate his last will and testament.